stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. It's the final Daily Maverick audio show of the year on cliffcentral.com. I'm joined in studio by Greg Nicholson, Simon Allison, and Ranjini Munasamy. And I'm your host, Stilly Sharalambos. We'll be going over some of the biggest stories that happened this year that filled the pages of the Daily Maverick, that caused debates in the editorial newsroom and out there amongst the reading public. So some of the biggest stories, I think, you know, looking back just from a South African context, we often debate about this and we chuckle at how it really is the gift that keeps on giving. It's not, you know, you struggle to go a week or two before the next big scandal breaks onto our newspapers and our computers. And started off on a note for you, Greg, following some of the shootings by South African Police Service around the country.
Yeah, I was saying just before we went on air that it seems quite crazy now that so much has happened this year that we forget one of the early stories of this year is the sort of elections were starting to heat up with these protests that were happening across the country. And in a number of instances, we saw police open fire on protests using live ammunition and kill them. And then I think it was just last week or the week before, we also saw in the Eastern Cape police kill, I think it was two protesters or one that died over in the Eastern Cape as they were trying to get the goods from a turned over rice truck. And it sort of really hit home at the policing problems we have in South Africa that really were apparent after the Marikana killings in 2012, and they spurred up again this year. And we have to sort of ask ourselves as we come to the end of the year, why does this continue happening, and how can the police transform, or will they ever transform to actually become a service rather than a militarized force?
And will they learn any lessons?
It seems not.
You know, if we look back to the Andries Tatane incident, we look back at Marikana, it doesn't look like they've taken their fingers off the trigger at all.
It seems not. And I think one of the bigger things is training. To learn lessons, we have to have cops who are trained and know what they're doing in these situations and how to handle themselves in quite volatile, you know, these quite dangerous and volatile situations, but they don't. And so history just seems to keep on repeating itself.
I've got to say, it's not limited to South Africa, this trend. I've noticed that this year, particularly continentally, you look across Africa and some of the major countries, Kenya and Nigeria in particular, where the militarization of the police forces is a really big trend. I'm not sure why all leaders think it's a good idea to sort of introduce these military concepts into the way they deal with domestic disputes. I think it's because leaders have this need to look hard. They need to look like they're in control, in charge. And when there's a problem, sending in the military or sending in police that look like military is the most powerful image you can send. But it's been repeatedly shown over and over again that it is not the most effective way of dealing with major threats like terrorism, which is what they're dealing with in Nigeria and Kenya,
to service delivery concerns, right?
Exactly.
I think we've seen two very different situations on different sides of the world, where in Hong Kong you had peaceful protests, pro-democracy protests, and in the United States, in Ferguson and other parts of the United States, where you've had extremely violent protests, and there again you've had the security forces being marched out, or rather the police services being marched out against civilians, and all that does is cause further aggression. Now you've seen that in Hong Kong, that was not the response. Rather, you know, it was just a demonstration of people power.
China being the role model for dealing with protesters.
Yes, and you know, in the United States, it swung completely the other way, where the momentum of the protests is picked up, particularly because of the response of the government.
And we see it again and again here. When you go to protests, there's a similar pattern that happens every single time. The protesters start early in the morning around 4 a.m. after months and months of service delivery concerns, be it water, housing, electricity, whatever it is. Then they go to the streets and they burn tires, and they'll often close down a road to try and get attention, maybe throwing some rocks at cars or things like that. Police are deployed. Usually the metro cops go there first. And eventually what happens is there's often a bit of a standoff between the police and the protesters. And at some point, police generally either want to push the protesters back off the road, or they decide, no, they just need to close this thing down. And then what happens is the SAPS generally and the Nyalas drive up, shoot tear gas or stun grenades or rubber bullets at the protesters. And what often goes from being sort of a simmering standoff turns into a very violent conflict. And the police fuel this by largely attacking these protesters rather than sort of engaging them or just allowing them their distance. But something clearly needs to change because people will continue to die if this approach continues.
I have an idea.
Here we go.
We should replace the Nyalas. Those Nyalas, they send shivers down my spine every time I see them. They're really nasty looking machines. And exactly, yeah. It has all that old echoes of our terrible history.
Yeah, and just painting them a different color doesn't help.
No, it doesn't help. So let's replace them with ice cream trucks.
Do they dispense ice cream or is this a ploy?
No, they just dispense ice cream. Imagine, you know, the police rock up and be like, guys, just have some ice cream, okay?
Ice cream doesn't cut it in South Africa. You need chicken trucks. Fried chicken trucks.
Yeah, and make sure it's the leg. It's got to be the leg. But just getting back to the service delivery protests. Ranjini, were you surprised that didn't play as big a role as it could have in the elections, which was probably the biggest story of the year in South Africa from a media perspective? Are you surprised it didn't play a bigger role?
You know, the thing with protests in South Africa is that we have amongst the highest rate of protests in the world, and it's there consistently. It's just that there are few of them that make the news because of the violent nature, and they tend to block roads and that kind of gets media attention. But there's consistently disgruntlement amongst communities that are not sort of, you know, not channeled and we don't become aware of it. And I think, you know, but what happens is that a different phenomenon happens during an election campaign because, you know, people flood communities, politicians flood communities, and they give some kind of temporary relief to people's complaints because they give the impression that they are listening. When you know it's all part of the campaign game, so we've seen that there was kind of a drop in the amount of protests just before the election, and that's because that there was this one of was that the ANC flooded the country right across the country wall to wall, but also because there were parties like the EFF which provided a different dimension to South African politics where they were saying to communities, we here now, we're going to take up your grievances and you're going to be heard on a national platform. So I think there's also been a little bit of watching and waiting as to see how dynamics are playing out, particularly in Parliament. And certainly the EFF does give the impression to communities, especially, you know, the poor and frustrated communities, that they are channeling their interests on issues such as land and delivery. And unemployment and things like that. So I think that's the reason that, you know, there hasn't been such a prevalence of service delivery protests as there has been in previous years.
But I think also it's often people seem to assume, and, you know, there's this question from a lot of people that say, why are people are protesting, but then the ANC continues to get voted in these areas. Mm-hmm. I think it's wrong for people just to assume just because there's a service delivery protest, the residents of a certain community will vote for someone else. One doesn't necessarily equal the other.
Especially also at a national level.
That's right, national and provincial levels. And often the issues when service delivery protests happen are often very localized. And it doesn't necessarily mean they want a change of the ANC. They might want a change of that councillor, but they might also think that the ANC is still best placed to deliver for them. And I think what Ranjini was touching on is previously in the past, if you were protesting, perhaps even if you didn't want the ANC, there wasn't particularly a viable alternative to vote for when the DA is often still not seen as a party for the poor majority of South Africans. Now that the EFF is coming in and making a lot of waves, that could change, but we're still waiting to see what happens. And I think the 2016 municipal elections will be extremely interesting to see then if on a local level we do see some sort of shift in these communities that have sort of caused a lot of strife for the state in the past.
Ranjini, are you expecting to see a difference, a big difference between the national and the local elections, the municipal elections next year?
Well, the elections in 2016, so there's some time. Yeah. And I think that, you know, how the year plays out next year will have a lot to do with it. You know, this was an extremely rocky year in South African politics. And we saw the dynamics change a lot with the entrance of the EFF in parliament. And I think that, you know, they are going to continue to rock the boat next year. And I think that they will make a play for certain big municipalities, but so will the Democratic Alliance. I think there will be a big play for Gauteng, particularly Johannesburg, Ekurhuleni and Pretoria, and then Port Elizabeth in the Eastern Cape, I think Cape Town. The big metros, I think that there will be major fights. But, you know, I think by and large, in the rest of South Africa, I don't think that there will be too much change. But I think what will happen is that there will certainly be more, or rather a reduction of the ANC's dominance in municipalities. So, and I think that will be a healthy sign for democracy. But the thing is that with this, comes power struggles. There'll be a battle for resources. There'll be the fights over municipal tenders and things like that. So I think that there'll be a lot more instability and aggression. Fighting, you know, at different levels of government. So, yeah, I think that the South Africa is changing. It's beyond the honeymoon period now after 20 years. And
honeymoon period, 20 years.
A long honeymoon. But certainly for the ANC, it has been. They haven't confronted any kind of major challenge up to now.
Someone described it the other day as the end of the beginning. For this country, and I thought that was quite a poignant way of looking at what we're going through and what's happening right now. And I think if we look at what's happening in Parliament, the changes, I don't know if we could say the ANC is on the back foot, but definitely facing more pressure and more challenges than they have in the last 20 years of being the ruling party in this country.
Well, look, I think that the last 12 months has been kind of like us crossing some sort of bridge with the passing of Nelson Mandela, with the fifth democratic elections, the introduction of the new parliament, I think that the memory of apartheid is now receding. You've got a lot more youth voters, and I think that that there isn't as much of a strong cohesion to the ANC, sentimental cohesion to the ANC as they used to be in the past. So I think that now there's a new era. Certainly the country is, the perceptions of the country internally and externally are changing significantly. And I think that the difficulties that we are going through, both through the economy, the downgrades in the country's ratings, the problems with the power supply, the breakdown of our certainly big parastatals, state-owned enterprises. I think all of that is starting to change perceptions South Africans have about the country and the government significantly. And I think that will have an ultimate impact on how people vote. Because up to now, I think for large sections of the population, it's been extremely difficult to go into a voting booth to look at the ANC flag and know the history behind it and vote for another party. For large sections of the population, you can't do that. If there's just too much history and sentiment behind that ANC flag. But I think that because of the way that the country has evolved, particularly over the last 12 months, you're going to find that a lot more people will be open to other choices.
And the challenge for the ANC isn't that all of their supporters who previously have voted in ANC whether they think the ANC, they're going to vote for the ANC because of history and the struggle, or whether they think the ANC is the best party to deliver services or to push for a non-racial united South Africa. It's the sum that some people may not do that anymore. So as their majority dwindles, it's not like everyone all of a sudden is going to start thinking, disregard the ANC's history or not think the ANC can deliver on services. But as that figure dwindles, that's where they're going to have a real challenge, particularly when we come up to the municipalities. And it might only be a few percent in certain areas that really gives them problems.
So as more young people enter the voting bracket, as more urbanization happens, we're going to see an erosion of that glow of liberation at the voting polls, I think, is a way of doing it, of explaining that. Simon, before we go on to the recently announced Daily Maverick Person of the Year, which will probably take up the majority of the rest of the show, The biggest stories from the continent this year, things that spring to mind, Boko Haram, Bring Back Our Girls, Al-Shabaab, numerous attacks on the continent.
Egypt, the chaos up there.
Libya, even more chaos there. It's been a bad year, actually.
Was the war in DRC this year? The Eastern Russians?
That was end of last year.
Okay,
but it gets confusing. The last 3 years, I've done at the end of every year, I've done a Africa for Pessimists. I sort of round up the five worst stories of the year, and then an Africa for Optimists the next day, where I round up the five most encouraging stories of the year. I'm putting that together today and tomorrow, actually, for this year. And you know what? There's just so much in the Africa for Pessimists. 2014 has been a really, really bad year for
Not to mention
continent.
Ebola.
Not to mention Ebola. So look, we've had Ebola. We've had South Sudan fracturing into civil war. We've got Boko Haram in Nigeria not doing their usual thing. They're transforming from a guerrilla movement into an actual secessionist movement that are taking territory and controlling it. It's turning into a civil war in Nigeria. You've got complete anarchy in Libya. That's the only word to describe it, because there is no government. There are these, 12 different competing centers of power. No one knows what the hell is going on.
ISIS could conceivably have its own country very soon.
ISIS does. ISIS already has three firm footholds on the African continent. One in Egypt, one in Libya, and increasingly in Nigeria as well. This is extraordinary.
What do you have in the optimist section?
It's a good question. I've been trying hard.
Well, there have been some successful elections.
I'm going to have an elections, especially in Southern Africa. Mm. We've had, I think, five SADC elections this year, and all have gone very, very smoothly. That's fantastic.
Thank goodness we still have Robert Mugabe.
We've still got Robert Mugabe. All is still well with the world.
You kind of know it's been a bad year when Bob's sort of like faded into the background. Yeah. It doesn't even make the news anymore.
Exactly. What else in the good news column? Burkina Faso? The people power. I'm not sure. It still could go either way. I'm choosing to take the optimistic view because, frankly, I need content.
Lesotho had an upheaval, but it stabilized.
Yeah, and it was a nothing. It didn't affect the country, really.
Didn't affect us.
It didn't affect us for once. What else in the good news column? I've got Aliko Dangote, the richest man in Africa, investing something like $9 billion in building a Nigerian oil refinery, which I think is a great story, because what Nigeria does at the moment is they pump all this oil out the ground, they send it to China, and then China sends back petrol, which is just, just crazy. And they're paying huge prices for the
transport and the fuel. Refinery
and what happens is actually petrol in Nigeria is quite cheap, but that's because the government is subsidizing it. So all the money the government earns from the oil is going into subsidizing petrol, because they know they have to give the people cheap petrol because they're an oil-producing country. Politically, petrol in Nigeria must be cheap. But it's not cheap because that's where the petrol is. It's cheap because the government's funneling all the profits, the ones that aren't being stolen, into subsidizing it. So I think that's a great initiative.
And the dropping of charges against Kenyatta, is that a good or bad story?
Well, this is, can we talk about the African Person of the Year, Stilly? So this year's Daily Maverick African Person of the Year. It's the first time we have given this... Is it an award? I'm not sure.
A title.
We thought about it, and we figured the person who's made the most impact on the African continent, for good and bad, is President Uhuru Kenyatta, the president of Kenya. And he has had quite a remarkable year. The biggest thing, of course, is that he has escaped scot-free from his charges at the International Criminal Court. It never got to the trial stage. He never had to mount a defense. And that is because the prosecution could not get access in Kenya to any of the documents or witnesses it needed to. There was a very nasty campaign of intimidation against the witnesses. Some died, some disappeared, some were too scared to testify, some changed their testimony at the last minute. Now, of course, there's no direct link between Kenyatta and this campaign of intimidation, but it just happens to be that all the witnesses that got got intimidated were the ones that were gonna go against him. Also, the court has been unable to access key financial records, and that was really Kenyatta's role. Now, this is one of the richest men in Kenya. The Kenyatta family is the richest family in Kenya. And his role in the post-election violence, allegedly, was the finance master. He was the one making sure everyone got the money to do all the various nasty things that they were doing. And without access to those financial records, they can't prove that. But of course, who in the Kenyan, even if Kenyatta is not deliberately blocking it himself, who in the Kenyan government is going to say, you know what, technically this body that I control, whatever, the Auditor General say, is an independent body, and therefore I will hand over documents that are going to incriminate my Commander-in-Chief, who appointed me, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
It's the same situation with Nkandla.
Mm. Exactly.
We have a massive cover-up.
Yeah. And again,
With higher stakes.
It's not necessarily Zuma initiating the cover-up.
Yes.
It's just the fact of
the perception
position.
Of number one.
It's people know what they are expected to do.
But surely this is an indictment on the effort to find out what happened in Kenya's post-election violence and find some sort of justice to that, because surely the Kenyan system isn't going to bring any truth
out. But the problem here is Kenyans. Kenyans voted for Kenyatta. Mm. The moment they voted for Kenyatta as president, that's the moment Kenya, the majority of Kenyans, chose not to pursue justice for the victims of post-election violence.
And you
violence.
Saw the send-off as well when he went off to the ICC. Mm. It was like a hero going off
it's
into
crazy.
Battle.
I mean, and that's been Kenyatta's genius in this, is he has transformed this stain on his reputation to
a campaign platform.
Some kind of campaign platform. Yeah. And he's turned it into a badge of honor. Mm. He's turned himself into the poster child for victimization and bias against Africans. And he's leading the fight against neo-colonialist, this, you know, bias international justice. I mean, it's crazy the things that he's been able to get away with.
And that touches why he's our person of the year, doesn't it? Because it's not just about Kenya. It's about his position
exactly.
within Africa and that relationship to the West.
I mean, he has. I mean, earlier this year, African leaders voted to give themselves immunity at the new African Court of Justice.
Why not, if they can?
But that was completely at Kenya's behest. Mm. Without Kenya pushing for that, that wouldn't have happened. I mean, that's the scale of the changes. Kenyatta, almost single-handedly, has now given African leaders immunity in their own continent from serious crimes.
Because, I mean, what could possibly go wrong with that, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Blanket immunity.
But it's not just this international justice issue. Within Kenya, Kenyatta has been extraordinarily influential this year. What he is doing, because of course Kenya is deeply involved in Somalia, which is another element in pushing back Al-Shabaab, and of course Al-Shabaab are reacting and are launching a huge number of attacks in Kenya. And what Kenyatta is doing to combat this is, as we mentioned before, he's militarizing the police. He is sort of tacitly authorizing this counterterrorism unit within the police to embark on a series of extrajudicial killings, torture, arbitrary arrests. He's slowly turning Kenya into sort of like a soft military state. Which, I mean, this is crazy for Kenya. This is Kenya. This is one of the strongest civilian governments we have on the continent that's slowly being eaten away. That civilian aspect is being eaten away. And Kenyatta is presiding over that. So he's fundamentally changing the character of his country as well. So that's why he is our person of the year, because he has just been so extraordinarily influential, both on the continent and within his own country.
Yes, but you compare, for example, how he is perceived in his country and the continent compared to how Goodluck Jonathan is perceived in his country. You know, I think that the kidnapping of the girls exposed him very badly, you know, and exposed that he's not in control of his country. Mm. So I think that in terms of perception, people are swinging more towards the Kenyatta-type rule.
Bear in mind that Kenyatta has credibility and legitimacy. He is the son of Jomo Kenyatta, the founding father, the Nelson Mandela figure of Kenya. Like, this is not some random. Goodluck Jonathan does not have that. Goodluck Jonathan has no natural constituency of his own. He was never meant to be president. He was only got there because Umaru Yar'Adua died in office. So Goodluck Jonathan he's constantly having to prove himself. Kenyatta doesn't have that problem.
But if we look at Kenyatta and his sort of firm rule and the increasing militarization of the state, he's still unable to stop attacks from al-Shabaab within Kenya. Do you think that will deteriorate his legitimacy?
Well, this is this weird contradiction that leaders always, you know, I mean, America's done exactly the same thing with the war on terror. They go for the hardline military approach to solving terrorism. And I think that's because they think that's what the public demands, and perhaps they're right, you know.
Because it builds patriotism as well, because people feel they're under siege.
And I think that's a big part of it, is that, yes, it's not, I don't think it's going to stop the attacks. I think it's completely the wrong way to go about stopping the attacks. One of his major things this year has been a huge police operation to arrest ethnic Somalis, just because they're Somalis. I mean, if you're walking down the street and you look Somali, you get arrested. That's what's going on in Kenya at the moment. Now, Kenya has historically had a large ethnic Somali population. Mm. Many of them are Kenyans and have been for several generations. Now they're being locked up. Where does that put them politically? What does that do to a person, you know, walking down the street and you get locked up? Well, suddenly you're not Kenyan anymore. You're looking for other political options, and maybe you find your home in al-Shabaab. So repeatedly, that's what's happening. It is fueling the next wave of terrorism, what he's doing now, but it is making him look good to his natural constituency. And I think that's the important bit as far as he's concerned.
I want to bring the focus back home a little bit, and also, you know, Ranjini, after years being on the political beat, you wrote
years and years,
years and years.
Yes. Moving along. Moving.
You wrote an article that became the most read article of all time on Daily Maverick, called "The Pistorius Trial: The Arrogance, the Privilege, the Farce, the Insult." And it's quite ironic that today the appeal is being heard to take against the murder conviction, or the lack of the murder conviction today. And this is a story that just kind of gripped the entire nation and a lot of the world. A lot of you know, the world's media, you know, descended on South Africa. We as a country, our justice system was under scrutiny. And then this article came out, and I think you kind of sort of tapped into pretty much what a lot of people were feeling and thinking and saying it, you know, at those Grumperati dinner parties. Where do you think this appeal will go, and what do you think the trial did for this country and our perception and brand South Africa?
Look, you know, I think we are an extremely engaged society. With every new thing, as you were saying earlier, every week or every 2 weeks, there's something new. But I think that's from the moment the news broke on the 14th of January, 2013, there has been something extraordinary about the Oscar Pistorius case. And one of it was because of the personality, his achievements, what he represented both in sport and I think in human achievement for South Africa. And you know, South Africa is in desperate need of heroes, for good guys. Because there's so many bad guys, there's so many bad stories around, and I think Oscar Pistorius was a good story to tell, to use ANC parlance, for a long time. And you know, he built himself up against the odds, and I think that once the news broke that he had shot his girlfriend, and these two personalities emerged, you had South Africans taking sides. And it was more than just a murder trial. I think it was a trial of our society, because there were so many other issues that rotated around it as well, such as, just violence in general in our society, gender violence, issues of security, and then the justice system and how it operates. And I think, you know, that it was, yes, it was the personality of Oscar Pistorius. It was also these huge legal minds doing battle in a South African courtroom. And the evidence that was presented, the nature of the case and all the issues that were brought into it. And I think that, you know, different people tapped into different aspects of it. For example, you know, when the defense was presenting its case about Oscar's need to protect himself and protect somebody he loved. And people found themselves in that room. And then the other side of it, where you are a young woman who gets involved with a young man who's this huge personality in South Africa, but not everybody does that. But still, you enter into a relationship with somebody in a society where gender violence is so dominant and people behaving badly so dominant. And you take that risk and then you end up dead. You know, and I think that different people in our society are related to different aspects of this trial in different ways. And I think that is why it sucked so much public attention. Yes, the media responded to it in an unprecedented way with the Oscar channel and with the tweeting, you know, around the clock about it and things like that. But I think that there was something else. There was some other phenomenon about it. But I think that is why the outcome was so disappointing for us as a society, because it was bad behavior being excused for other aspects, and that is why I wrote that piece. That
checkbook justice was, yes, I think what you called it.
Yes, it was checkbook justice, but it was also this thing that the aggressor in this, the guy who pulled the trigger, became the victim. And too far too often in South Africa, there's this use of victimhood to excuse bad behavior. We've seen it time and time again with Jacob Zuma, where it was a political conspiracy against him. It got him off a rape charge. It got him off a corruption charge because he was supposedly a victim of conspiracy. But he continues to behave badly. And there's this continuous need to excuse his behavior as being because he is some sort of victim. We've seen this taken to ridiculous proportions on the Nkandla matter, where the ANC MPs in parliament are claiming that he is the victim of the opposition, of the media, of everybody else, because he got this big house and he didn't ask for it. You know?
Yeah. And poor Jay-Z.
Yes.
It's like the knee-jerk reaction is to claim victimhood rather than be accountable.
Yes. And you see, that's the phenomenon I think that we have to deal with as a society, is that there is no account, and that is why there is the sense in South Africa that there is no accountability for everything that goes wrong, whether it's in Nkandla, whether it's Oscar, whether it's Shian Diwani, whether it's the electricity crisis.
Whether it's potholes.
Dina Pule, like.
Yes. You know, all these things happen. People get away with it. Sometimes a slap on the wrist, sometimes a couple months in jail, and sometimes they just get to like wander off back to their normal lives, like Shian Diwani.
You mentioned the media and the unprecedented response that we had to this case. And Greg, you were involved in a lot of those scrums at the courthouse.
I thought service delivery protests were bad.
Yeah, you should see Reuters and the Daily Mail reporters.
The Daily Mail actually are bad. I can confirm that. Go on.
How was it for you personally to see this sort of international media attention on the country? And also the differences with how they approached coverage of the trial to the way we approached, if there were any.
I guess looking back, it's a little bit hard to say, because initially it was just a shock, you know, when we went to the first bail hearings at the Pretoria Magistrates Court, and we just saw so many of these TV tents from channels around the world that I've never even heard of. It was actually just a shock just to see how many people there. I was quite blown away. And I think after that, it was being there, it wasn't so much about judging these international sort of correspondents and things. I was actually trying to work around them, because there's so many of them also trying to access the same things, and there's so many people from all these different countries with all of their producers and assistants and things like that. It was actually quite a challenge just to do our work with them all there. But in terms of the content, you know, you had these moments where you might be walking past someone. I can give you an example. I remember on the first day of the case, outside the Pretoria High Court, when Oscar was supposed to arrive, and all of us photographers and the videographers and the cameramen are waiting outside in this scrum, you know, lining the hall of sort of creating this sort of hallway for Oscar to walk through. And we're all jostling there, and you're trying to stand firm and waiting for him to come. We're waiting for about 2 hours, I think, and people are smoking, drinking coffee. And then eventually Carl Pistorius comes in. And there was an Australian broadcaster from Channel 7 who leans out over the pack of journalists and just yells, "Oscar, how are you feeling today?" And it was Carl Pistorius. And all the local journalists just started laughing, you know, pissing themselves. And then he just sort of looked sheepish, you know, and said, "Oh, I didn't know. And that's how it often went throughout the case. We had the international guys, because they're catering to an international audience, they missed a lot of the nuances and read a lot into certain things, particularly on issues of gender-based violence, which local media did too. But, you know, we saw the we saw some of the reports saying that, you know, Pistorius is going to get killed in prison. This is the sort of prison he's going to. But I think a lot of the local media saw that often if you've got money and you're a celebrity, you're not going to get treated like Sky News says you're going to get treated in prison. So some of those different nuances, there are different nuances for the local and international media, and I think sometimes the international media bordered on the more sensational stories.
Was the story as big in Australia as, couldn't have been as big as it was here.
Well, I don't know about
that.
No, I don't know about that, actually. I think it might have been bigger, to tell you the truth. All of my family in Australia knew all of what's going on. And if you saw, I think we saw just, it was around the judgment. I saw like a pie chart of all the tweets that were coming out from around the world and about the Oscar trial and the different areas they were coming from. And although Australia only has a population of, I think, 21 million compared to South Africa's 51, there were more tweets coming from Australia about the Pistorius trial than South Africa.
Wow. Well, why do you think there was such big interest in the case?
I think largely because it's such a huge drama. First of all, Oscar Pistorius is known around the world, and in Australia he got a lot of headlines when he was trying to get approved to run with able-bodied athletes. So that was already a story, and a lot of people knew who he was. And then secondly, because I think Australia is, unlike South Africa, it's often a society yearning for drama. Where there aren't.
It was the end of Neighbours season.
That's right.
97.
That's right. The scandals. Of course, there are scandals, political and social, and there is crime and things like that. But often not on this sort of scale. And so when something like this happens internationally, it's going to be followed largely for the voyeuristic sort of aspects to it, the law and order type aspect to it, because it's sensational, it's exciting, it's a story it's hard to turn away from.
I think we can go on to our Person of the Year. The Daily Maverick announced today the Person of the Year being Julius Malema. And you know, having discussed this at our last editorial meeting, there wasn't really any debate over who would be nominated as our Person of the Year. And I think, you know, looking back from in the build-up to the elections themselves, being able to get 6% on the back of, you know, just a few months worth of preparation, without having registered voters, was a massive success on behalf of the EFF and pretty much the person who's the entire driving force behind this. And since then, living up to the promises that were made to really shake things up. And you know, looking at what's happened in Parliament, looking at the emergence of the EFF, and obviously a lot of sizzle. We don't know how much substance there is behind it just yet. You know, I think it was safe to say there wasn't going to be anyone else, and you know, this really was Juju's year.
Yes, I think so. You know, I think that Julius Malema set out to when he started his political party, I think he set out to prove a point to the ANC, and I think he's made that point within a few months. In the way that he has been able to change the dynamics in South African politics so rapidly and so dramatically. And I think, you know, people kind of underestimated him. And I think that on the campaign
trail, at their peril.
Yes. You know, on the campaign trail, he showed what he's capable of. Greg and I went to the last ANC campaign rally at FNB Stadium. And at the same time, our colleague Richard Poplack and Tapelo Lekgoba were at the other one at Tembisa, was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And, you know, both are large gatherings of people who are extremely loyal, extremely dedicated. But the ANC has access to an enormous amount of resources. It has
half a billion rand.
102 years of history behind it. You know, that's not something to be like sneezed at. And you know, they have the ability to go out right across the country and rally people. They can bus people in. Whereas with the EFF, at that point, they were 7 months old. You know, they didn't have much resources, and yet you had people going there to that stadium from early in the morning, standing in the blazing sun and waiting just for that moment to see, be able to listen to Julius Malema. And, you know, to be able to watch Julius Malema, Greg and I went to the launch of his manifesto. There was so much rubbish, you know, that he belted out. For example, that, you know, he would raise the national minimum wage to or there isn't one at the moment, but he wanted to pitch it at 7,500 per, you know, for like domestic workers, for builders, that kind of thing. And people drink it up. You know, he is like the TB Joshua of South African politics.
He's an incredible populist.
Yes. And he knows which
buttons
to press.
Don't sleep over Julius' house.
You know, he knows what buttons to press. He knows how to get a crowd going. He knows what to say. At that the launch of the manifesto, you know, he was there belting out all this rubbish. And then the next thing, he marches out all these Marikana widows onto the stage. It was a powerful moment because that community has been completely forgotten and neglected by the ANC, and he knew how to reach out to mining communities to say, people like you were killed. Yeah, the people were left behind. They're with me now. You know, and he's taken one of them with him to parliament. You know, she doesn't have like the credentials and education that other MPs have, but she's there. She's sitting in the House of Parliament, able to make decisions, sit on extremely powerful communities. And that's what he's done. He's got 25 MPs in parliament at the moment. They are rocking it. They are making a huge impression out of those 400 people sitting in that house. And I think the moment for South Africa was that day in August when the president went to go and answer questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was really something to behold, because Musi Maimane comes with the weight of the Democratic Alliance. He's got they an established party. He went, he was there. He was asking the president question, and the president was able to silence him and basically say, you know, sit down, I'm not going to answer you. But Julius Malema stood up, and what happened? You know, it ended with the riot police having to come in.
He took service delivery protest to Parliament.
To Parliament, yes.
You know, he promised to do. He promised to change Parliament.
And he lectured the president. Yeah. He lectured him. He said to him, you know, you must stop this. This thing of points of order and things to excuse you being held accountable. Pay back the money. When are you going to answer? You know, and the president was sitting there stunned. We've seen Jacob Zuma in so many different contexts. I've never seen him like standing there like a deer in the headlights, not knowing what to do or what to say. You know, normally he's able to just chuckle and walk off and get away with it. And that was the one moment in time when he was not able to. He was standing there so long that one of the ANC MPs actually had to come and hold his hand and said, come sit down, you know, when the protest was going on. So you could see that this is the impact of the economic freedom fighters and Julius Malema as it hit.
Hasn't it also been quite interesting to see that sort of, I don't know what the politically correct way of calling it is, you know, the moderate opposition, pale-faced moderate opposition, completely almost changing.
You're trying to say the white DA conservatives.
Yes, yes. But almost like not DA members or let's say what would, you know, maybe traditionally be described as their sort of target market voting base. But perceptions of Julius Malema have changed. You know, now that he's sort of the almost the spearhead of the opposition.
Bad choice of words, by the way.
Yeah. But, you know, we were 12 months before, you know, he was this buffoon firebrand leader of the Youth League, you know, that he mismanaged into its death, basically. But is now, you know, in that 12 months, which shows the political genius of the man, and why we gave him the title of Person of the Year, who's had this impact on the country, on, you know, taking opposition to the, you know, to the fight to the government that we haven't seen before.
Yes, I mean, you've seen that, you know, his impact on parliament is that suddenly, like, very conservative DA MPs are fighting with police and showing off their bruises on Twitter and things that would never have happened in the past. But I think that, you know, this militancy that he's brought to parliament, people need to adapt to it. The other opposition parties are having to adapt it. You've seen the Freedom Front Plus suddenly becoming extremely militant, which is very funny, you know. But they are having to adapt it. And you see the ANC completely on the back foot. They do not know how to handle the economic freedom fighters. They don't know what kind of response, how to defend themselves, how to defend the president. They have instructions from the Thuli House to basically use their majority against it. But it's becoming more and more difficult, even with the Speaker of Parliament being a high-profile member of the ANC. They still are not able to get the better of the EFF. The EFF has this attitude, is we don't care what you do. Take our salary, suspend us. we will still be here to make the point. And I think that there is, the ANC has a gun to their heads now because they don't know what is going to happen when Parliament reopens with the State of the Nation address, because there is a threat hanging over them. And they know that when Julius Malema promises something, he usually does what he says he will do.
Ranjani, to what extent is the EFF just Malema's cult of personality? I mean, say Malema were to die in a bus crash tomorrow, what happens to the party then?
I think that it would wither away. I think it's very much about Julius Malema at the moment. And yes, there are some other strong personalities, but I think none of them would be able to keep the momentum going if he had to die or something like that. And I think that was the danger for them with the court cases against him. Because if he is prohibited from participating in Parliament, I think the EFF will be in trouble. I think it will go the same way as COPE and things. It will reach a peak and then to fade away. I think it is very much a cult of personality because people relate to him and relate to what he says.
I think that on some level Parliament has been good for the EFF on that front, because it has allowed some of their other members and MPs that we had never heard of before or didn't really know to step up when Julius Malema's on study leave or Floyd Chavumble's not there.
Flip the bird to the deputy president.
we have gotten to know some other EFF members behind Malema, which although it won't make up for the loss of Malema if he ever does go or something happens to him, it will at least they do have some other support, some other members that the public now knows.
Are we going to look back at 2014 in 20 years' time, say, as a watershed moment in South African politics? If we're taking into account the emergence of the EFF, what's happened in Parliament, the dissolution of the alliance, or what looks like will become the dissolution of the alliance. Does this have the makings of being the watershed for the next 20 years of South African politics?
I think we still have to reach the major turning point. You know, there have been like several major developments this year, one of which was the breakup of COSATU, the expulsion of NUMSA, and also the outcome of the elections, the big fright that the ANC got in Gauteng. So that was a big wake-up call. So yes, there were major developments in the country, but I think we still have to reach that big turning point. You know, I think Nkandla has brought us to the brink, in terms of the failure of executive accountability and things.
But if you add all those things together, Nkandla, Eskom, Parliament, EFF, the elections, the NUMSA's expulsion, you add all those things up together, it feels like we can't be far away from
the
turning point.
We're not far
away.
I think, for example, if you have a national blackout, which is possible, I think then that could push things over the edge. I think that our economy is fast reaching junk status. The message from the finance minister at the medium term budget policy statement was that things are extremely bad, and it looks as if we are getting to that point. Yesterday at the Eskom press conference, we're looking at a very bad month. They announced that they don't have diesel to keep the lights on in February, in particular. We could be reaching that breaking point quite soon. And I'm not sure that it's a completely bad thing for the country, because I think we let things go quite quickly here in South Africa. Bad things happen and we let it go. You know, this family came in and landed their wedding jet at Waterkloof Air Force Base. It's a military facility. And what did we do? We all got outraged and then we let it go. We went to war in the Central African Republic and lost soldiers in battle and was, oh yeah, that happened. And we let it go. There's far too often where bad decisions are taken, bad things happen, and we simply move on from it. So I think it may take something with a crisis like a national blackout
What are we supposed to do? We get outraged and then we have an election, and that's where these things are supposed to be settled.
We have an election, but and also we have an engaged society. Remember that we had a very kind of activist society which broke the back of apartheid, mostly because communities stood up and spoke out and said that this is wrong. Now, I don't think that we need a civilian rebellion, But we need to be able to, yes, the election is the way to express discontent. And the 2016 is going to be that moment that's coming. But I think that a lot happens, like with the electricity crisis now. You know, people just accept it. They adapt to people's bad, to the new normal of things going wrong. And, you know, that we've seen it in other places in the continent and around the world, where a bad leadership is left to fester until it reaches a point of a national crisis. And I think that's why the decision is up to us now, as to when South African society speaks up and say, no, this is not good enough.
And I think while elections is one form of democratic accountability, it's not the only one. There are other ways we can try and hold the government or officials or business or all sorts of different sectors of our society to account. And we shouldn't just look to elections for that.
Well, it's time to wrap up the last Daily Maverick show of the year on Cliff Central. It's that time of the year when everyone and journalists take their break and head down to the coast to take their drugs and alcohol away. And while they hope that no one famous dies over this period and that aren't called back into work over that period. Guys, just a quick roundup. What are you looking forward to next year? What are the big things you're looking forward to, hoping for next year, that we see that we can have this discussion next year and hopefully in a little bit more of a little bit more favorite look back of the year?
I think in February, Jacob Zuma's due to the State of the Nation address again, and the EFF have said they won't let him do that. So I'm interested to see how that goes and what the red overalls get up to.
Well, there's COSATU is scheduled to hold a special national congress. I don't know if it will happen. If it doesn't, there's a regular congress that's an elective congress that's supposed to happen, that will get a new leadership elected at COSATU. And then mid-year in June, we'll have a wonderful time, Greg and I, at the ANC National General Council. So that should warm things up next winter. But I think for most of us, the big worry is whether the lights will stay on next year.
Continentally, well, all I can say is just I hope we manage to put out some of the fires that have erupted this year and that no new fires start again. This year seemed like there's a lot of new conflicts coming up, which we need to sort out quite urgently. The thing I'm most worried about next year is the potential spread within Africa of the Islamic State and its ideology and its particularly brutal tactics. That's the story I will be watching closest.
Okay, happy note to end 2014 on.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. happy holidays on that note.
And welcome to the Caliphate.
Yeah, thank you for joining us on this show and throughout the year. We look forward to bringing you more of this next year. And wherever you are, wherever you're traveling, be good to yourselves and each other.